Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The World Series is now best of five as the Fall Classic moves from the Gateway City to the Lone Star State. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll hear from a former Ranger and a Cards chronicler. Also, what's next for Indy racing after last Sunday's fatal crash in Las Vegas, and why many athletes are running away from the humdrum marathon and to adventure racing. Also coming up, a football stadium announcer calls games with a little help from his sighted friends.
Whatever he can't see, it's my job to tell him what's going on so that he can tell the people downstairs. He does a great job of it. I don't think anybody down there that doesn't know David would know there's a blind guy up here.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday in St. Louis, the Texas Rangers knotted the World Series at one game apiece, scoring two runs in the ninth to earn a 2-1 victory. The series will shift to Texas tonight for Game 3. Rangers fans hope their team will take advantage of the three-game homestand to overtake St. Louis and win the first World Series title in franchise history. Here to discuss that possibility is Pete O'Brien, who played for the Rangers from 1982 to 1988. Pete, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're still living in the Dallas area. What's the mood there as the series shifts to Texas, tied at one game apiece?
Well, it's quite exciting, Bill. You know, usually around this time, this is cowboy time. And the last couple of years, the Rangers have wrestled away the front pages. And, you know, it's a very easy team to root for. These guys are a humble group, very hungry group. And it's been fun to watch them. And the other night in St. Louis, for them to come back and win that game in the ninth is something that we've been watching the last couple of years out of this group.
When you were with the Rangers, the team never made the playoffs. In fact, Texas didn't make the postseason until 1996, eight seasons after you left. You then played 1 year for Cleveland, four with Seattle. They didn't make the postseason. Does the Rangers' recent success kind of erase some of that, what must have been disappointment?
Well, it helps, for sure. You know, you play this game, and there's a lot of things that have to stack up for you to get the postseason. For the most part, everybody's enjoying this run by the Rangers, you know, since Nolan came and Jimmy Sundberg and these guys have come back to the organization and really wanted to make it a top-flight organization, and they have with John Daniels on down to Ron Washington and the rest of the group.
Well, you mentioned Hall of Fame pitcher Nolan Ryan, who is president and CEO of the club, as well as senior executive vice president Jim Sundberg, who had a very exceptional career as a major league catcher. This must be a kind of where it all starts, I would think, in terms of inspiring great performances.
Well, there's no doubt. You know, Nolan doesn't miss a game down there in the owner's box, so I have a feeling those pitchers probably look over there every now and then, just want to see how Nolan's reacting to their performance. It's like your grandfather or your father watching you in the stands, and, you know, you want to perform, and Nolan has been, you know, very beneficial to this group.
Of course, the flip side to the pitchers looking over at Nolan Ryan in the stands must be Ryan looking at them and occasionally thinking, what the heck's the matter with this guy? He can't throw 105 miles an hour.
Nolan had just a prolific work ethic. And so, you know, he's just demanding that. He's demanding that these guys put in their time off the field, you know, in between starts. So there's just a lot of good stuff that's flowing downhill.
Among the guys that you had as teammates were Bucky Dent and Mickey Rivers, who had both earned World Series rings with the Yankees. What was it like to be in the same locker room with guys who had won it all?
They were terrific, and they certainly had the credentials following them. But I think as a group, we didn't quite come together around them, and I don't know if it was they were in the twilight of their career, so you know, they may not have had the impact as they would have with the Yankees when they were younger, and everybody was kind of, you know, had that kindred spirit and one common goal. We fought that for years. That, and I just felt like, you know, it just takes a certain group that is committed, and they become, you know, a band of one, to use the old cliche. But that's really what it takes. I think it's, you know, this game's such an individual sport. You can get caught up in numbers, and when you start getting caught up in numbers, you start individualizing it, and I think that's where the difference between the championship teams and the you know, the middle of the road teams, they just have a common thought, you know, that it's all about wins and pennants and all that. It's a special group.
Pete, you and your wife Donna own and operate the At Peace Flotation Spa in Colleyville, Texas. In what ways would major leaguers benefit from visiting your facility?
Flotation therapy is just a great therapy as far as just stress relief and all that, but it's a great muscle relaxer as well. We've had a few players in here. I think for the most part during the season, it's tough to get them here. Cowboys and Phillies had it in the 80s, but for the most part, it's something that I think is really should be part of a wellness regime.
All right, I can't let you go without asking for a World Series prediction. I understand that there may be some bias involved, but who do you like?
Well, you know, my brother and I were texting last night, and he goes, how could Nolan pick him in six? And it was the top of the ninth, and we were starting to rally, so I texted him back, and I said he was just being nice because I think it may be in five. You know, but I kind of like the six. I think this is just like, you know, everybody's saying, these two teams are very similar, and Tony La Russa's teams don't give too many games away, so you got to earn them. And so I'll stick with Nolan. Why not? He's running the hot hand, and I'll say Rangers in six.
Pete O'Brien played first base for the Texas Rangers from 1982 until 1988, after which he logged a season in Cleveland and four more in Seattle. Pete, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You bet, Bill. Thanks for having me.
The St. Louis Cardinals are one of Major League Baseball's marquee teams, and the New York Times' George Vesey knows a bit about Cardinals history. He chronicled decades of same in his 2011 biography, Stan Musial, An American Life. George Vesey joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
It's nice to be back here. Thank you.
Everybody knows that the Yankees have the most World Series titles of any Major League Baseball team. They've got 27. But I would guess that if you quizzed a lot of baseball fans, they would not be able to name the team with the second most series wins, and that's the Cardinals with 10. Do you think I'm right about that?
Oh, I'm sure. And that would only confirm what people in St. Louis feel, the flyover insult of people flying over at 36,000 feet and saying, you know, down below is the gateway and not much else. They are convinced that Stan Musial hasn't had a lot of attention over the years, and particularly since retirement, because of the coastal bias. And they're probably right. So I would say that if people said, oh, it must be the Dodgers or the Red Sox or, you know, some other coastal team or even the downtrodden Mets, people would name them first, and the Cardinals, who knows, might be not by real ball fans, of course.
In chronicling the life of Stan Musial and learning about the Cardinals teams of the 40s and 50s and into the 60s, did you find any noteworthy similarities or dissimilarities between the way the team was run then and the way it's run now?
Well, certainly when Musial came along, I mean, there were hardly any rich teams in baseball. It was a mom-and-pop operation, and the Cardinals certainly were. They had a used car car salesman named Sam Braden owned the team, and they were not a wealthy team. And nowadays you have, you know, a lot more money at stake, but they are still a mid-market television team, and Bill DeWitt wisely runs them that way.
What has the presence of Stan Musial himself around the team over the last few years meant to the city?
You know, he's a living icon. I don't know of any, particularly an athlete, who means as much to one city, one athlete to one city, as Musial does to St. Louis. I mean, you know, L.A., New York, Chicago, they've got lots of icons, but St. Louis has the one. As Pujols says, when people call him El Hombre, he says there's only one man in this town, and that's Stan the Man. No, he is beloved. He is just beyond a baseball hero. He seems to be an embodiment of the St. Louis self-image of what people think about themselves as a decent place where you can go out and be a human being, not have to show off too much, give yourself out a little bit in public and not get burned by it. And that's what Musial is.
The Cardinals slipped into the playoffs on the last day of the regular season, and if they do go on to win the World Series this year, they would become one of just five wild card teams to accomplish that. You're a New Yorker, of course, but is it tempting for you to root for the Cardinals because their story is so compelling?
Well, as you point out, the Cardinals have been down this road before. As far as a wild card goes, well, a wild card only began in 1995, and I was there when the Yankees were striving to get in. To see Don Mattingly get so involved in being and wanting to be in the playoffs and wanting to play a postseason game. So I think the wild card has a lot of legitimacy. It's also only four teams, so you have the fourth best record in any league. I think that's reasonable to say you're getting pretty good teams. It's not like the NBA or the NFL or hockey. But having said that, I mean, the Cardinals are a good story. On the other hand, Texas never won anything until last year. I love seeing new teams in the World Series. As a World Series fan, and I guess the postseason is a concept that I'm a little slow in getting to, but the World Series is a separate entity, and I'm very happy to see new teams, even ones that haven't won in decades.
Well, you make a good point, because although the Cardinals barely slipped into the playoffs, really courtesy of the Braves, they really probably shouldn't be considered an underdog. Texas has never won a World Series.
Well, there is that. I mean, last year it was all so new to Texas, and then they got beaten by a better team, a team that was more hot at the time. But Texas has learned something, and as I've seen written and what I think is true is Texas is sort of an awakening giant of a team because of the money that's going to be available, that it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. As they go into the postseason more times with the players they've assembled, that they will also command more money on the television market. I mean, they are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Have you got a prediction for us as far as how this series comes out?
You know, I learned a long time ago that I'm not good at it and why do it? I mean, I'd like to, in a way, I'd like to think it's Texas's turn. But from what I see from day to day, the things that worked for the Cardinals in the first game did not work the second game. And La Russa had been pushing all the buttons. The second game, he brought in Arthur Rhodes, the same situation. And Rhodes, you know, gave up a sacrifice fly to a gutty professional hitter like Hamilton. It's just the way it is. You don't know from game to game. Washington's a good manager. They have very good players. So my prediction is one or the other. I guess Texas has. I mean, I don't think they're going to win three straight at home. I doubt that. But you never know.
New York Times columnist George Vesey is the author of Stan Musial, An American Life, and he joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. George, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There they go, and we want the world to know. Give a cheer, shout it clear, let them know that we're all here. That bunch of Cardinals and Mr. Hornsby, we're mighty proud of you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Nigel Richards of New Zealand was the winner at the recently completed World Scrabble Championships. He walked away from the table with $20,000, having scored 95 critical points with the word omnified, which my spell check, for one, didn't recognize. But never mind that. The real drama at the tournament, which occurred in Warsaw, saw a player from Thailand accusing his British opponent, Ed Martin, of hiding the letter G somewhere about his person. The Thai gentleman insisted that the Brit should be marched to the men's room and strip-searched. Tournament officials said they thought not, and Mr. Martin won that match by just one point. Gee.
I'm in it, I'm in the zone, remembering some words I have never known. Tonight I have a certain way of playing Scrabble. No longer will I say I merely dabble, winning the battle with every square. Hardly notice hot shots over there. My world is not the same. What a glorious game.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce breaks down the sports news of the week. But first, the investigation of last Sunday's deadly accident at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway was launched on Tuesday. The 15-car crash injured three drivers and took the life of two-time Indy 500 champion Dan Weldon, who was 33 years old. On Friday, a league official confirmed that IndyCar chief executive Randy Bernard will meet with the drivers on Monday to discuss the fatal accident. According to the Wall Street Journal, the changes implemented last year by Bernard were designed to increase risks on the racetrack and attract new fans. Alexandra Berzon, whose article Risks Haunted Fatal Race appeared in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, joins me now on the line from Los Angeles. Alexandra, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Tell us about Randy Bernard and what he has brought to the IndyCar series since he was installed as chief executive in March of 2010.
Had a career with the Professional Bull Riders, which was an interesting kind of organization that was started where they basically took a sport that was common at the end of rodeos and made a sort of professional sport out of that. And he was kind of around towards the beginning of, in I believe, the mid-90s with that group. And he was very successful. I mean, I talked to people from that organization. He was incredibly successful at getting TV deals, marketing, and even around that, that was a very dangerous, kind of exciting sport where a lot of the excitement comes around the danger. And he really kind of sold that. So he had this success. IndyCar, the league, was not faring well. And in 2010, they ousted the longtime CEO who was from the family that had owned the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, that owned the league, and installed Randy to become kind of the marketing guru and to really kind of pick up steam and expose the sport to a broader audience and kind of bring back some of the glory days, I think, to Indy racing.
It's no secret that fans of NASCAR enjoy on-track danger, but given the differences between stock car racing and open-wheel racing, did IndyCar and Bernard in particular underestimate the potential dangers of running a race like Sunday's Las Vegas 300?
You're definitely hearing it somewhat from some of the drivers who've actually been expressing some of these things all year. There's been other races in the last year and a half, 2 years, where drivers have complained about danger. And following this as well, I think there's been quite a bit of concern that, you know, you had someone new who might have underestimated some of those dangers. And in the prelude to the Las Vegas race, I found that there had been an article on the website. It was like a sort of press release from the league saying this race is going to be really dangerous, basically. Like, this is, they said the Las Vegas Speedway is very fast and smooth. And then they had a series of quotes from drivers saying, you don't know what's going to happen. One mistake could really have a huge impact, and it's going to be a nail biter for the fans. And it just speaks to the tension of what you're dealing with when you start to get into that territory of talking up the danger levels.
IndyCar, the Automobile Competition Committee, and Racing's international governing body are currently investigating the crash. What's likely to be the focus of that investigation?
I can't tell you exactly the focus because they haven't been forthcoming at all with what that's going to be. But I would suspect that, you know, a lot of it would be about the track itself and whether or not it was suitable for the particular cars.
Officials canceled testing of the new 2012 Indy car, which had been scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday at the Las Vegas Motor Speedway. What other actions might be taken immediately as a result of Sunday's crash?
You know, I talked to folks who had been concerned about different technical changes that the league has made to some of the rules and regulations in the last few years. Whether or not, you know, those things directly contributed to this crash is still unclear, and whether or not that they would be changed as a result of this or any other changes is also unclear. One thing to note is that they are having new cars next year, and several people I've talked to have said that they think that the cars will be safer. So it's up to the league to really create safety, and it's a tension. And I guess you have to find the right formula to keep people interested and also keep people safe.
As you point out in Tuesday's Wall Street Journal article, deadly crashes are rare in this sport. Should Sunday's tragedy be understood as a freak accident, or is there more that IndyCar can and should do to protect the drivers?
Based on the people in the sport that I've talked to, I think that there's a real division among folks at this point about that question. As far as from an outsider perspective, it would be hard to just chalk this one up to a totally freak accident. As a lot of people sort of put it, it's more of a perfect storm of a lot of different factors converging. I mean, I think it would take a lot of investigation to really answer the question fully, but I think so far, preliminarily, it points to more of a kind of convergence of factors rather than just as something completely freaky.
Long before Dan Weldon's death, many people in the U.S. had felt that open wheel racing had run its course in this country. That's why Randy Bernard was hired to reverse that opinion. Is it just a matter of time before that Indy League goes out of business?
Indy racing has a lot of pretty committed fans, it seems like. So I don't know, though. I mean, it's definitely expensive to keep it up. It had been on the way towards improving. Viewership on television had been picking up the last couple of years. You know, Randy Bernard had really been working hard on things like connections with Hollywood and trying to get more sort of mainstream attention to the sport. And what this will mean for that, I don't think we can say yet.
Alexandra Berzon, along with Rachel Bachman, has been covering the IndyCar investigation for the Wall Street Journal. She joined me on the line from Los Angeles. Alexandra, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org. The football stadium announcer's role is pretty straightforward. Quickly dispatched to eager fans, details such as how many yards were gained, who carried the ball, and who made the tackle. In Louisville, Kentucky, a father determined to play a part in his son's high school games wound up in that role, despite lacking an advantage many PA announcers take for granted. Ann Marshall has the story.
Fans pile on to silver and red bleachers as the Friday sunset leaves orange skid marks in the sky. Two of Kentucky's top high school football teams will soon emerge from locker rooms onto a freshly cut field.
It's a kind of a chilly night here in Kentucky. There's a little bit of breeze blowing through the window. It's about 65 degrees. I can smell the hot dogs and hamburgers that are being grilled downstairs.
That's David Holton. The 49-year-old is perched in the press box above the stands, wearing a crimson sports coat and tie, the school color of DuPont Manual High School. He's the school's varsity football announcer. David leans back on a stool and takes it all in.
We're about 30 minutes before kickoff. The teams are on the field. They're doing their drills. They're clapping their hands. They're doing their chants.
David's a huge fan of football and of a particular defensive lineman for DuPont Manual, his son, Brooks. His avocation began 3 years ago when a parent called him in a panic.
It was about 3 hours before the game started. He said, "We don't have an announcer." I said, "Well, I'll be glad to do it, but, you know, I can't see. I can talk, but I can't see."
David is blind. A tumor damaged his optic nerve when he was 10 years old. He can only see lights, like the ones glaring at Manual Stadium. But that doesn't prevent him from doing his job.
Your game time temperature is 64 degrees. It's Friday night, it's 7:30, and it's time for football!
David's sandwiched in a room not much longer or wider than a bathtub. An unobstructed view of the field lies before him. A scoreboard operator sits on one side, two spotters stand nearby, and press binoculars to their eyes. Buddy, an 11-year-old black lab seeing eye dog, wedges himself underneath David's legs.
Pass play.
What happened?
Pass.
That's Thomas Pattison, David's loyal spotter and friend.
Natalie's pass is complete.
Matthew Winter with the catch.
Matthew Wimpy with the reception. First down.
Yes.
First down, Tigers. Was that tackle or taking on bounds?
Six. Number six for me.
Who was that?
It's Percy.
Percy Minor?
Percy Minor.
Tackle by number six, Percy Minor.
During each down, David gently swings from side to side and waits for someone to tell him what's going on. Pattison holds a roster for both teams.
Stopped at the line. I'm trying to see his number. Yulinski.
What number is he? 41. Tackle by number 41, Jacob Lewinsky.
Pattison is integral to this tag team, but he gives most of the credit to his partner.
Whatever he can't see, it's my job to tell him what's going on so that he can tell the people downstairs. And he does a great job of it. I don't think anybody down there that doesn't know David would know there's a blind guy up here.
Tackle by number 92, Thomas Chapman. And number 51, Brooks Holton.
Second and eight.
That's my boy.
David's pride occasionally earns him some good-natured ribbing from others in the press box.
He gets a little nervous every now and then, so sometimes we'll just call 51 for the hell of it, you know.
Make him feel better.
Just keep in a good mood.
I can't wait to throw the pass.
He said, Dad, I didn't make seven tackles tonight.
If I say you did, son. That's all that matters.
David says football has been a great bond between him and his oldest son, number 51, Brooks Holton. And he loves to tell the story of number 39.
When Brooks first started playing football, this was when he was 10 years old, he came to me one night after practice and said, Dad, what number did you wear when you played football? I said, I was number 39, son. I said, why do you ask? He said, I just wondered. Well, about 2 weeks later, he came home from football practice with his jersey. He was number 39. It was pretty neat.
David's never seen Brooks's face, nor his red hair. Still, he can toss a football or baseball to him like any other dad. He played both sports before he lost his sight. The two sit next to each other in the high school's alumni room, sports memorabilia encased from floor to ceiling.
I'm a quarterback. I can't be the receiver because I can't see to catch it, but I can still throw a football.
Yeah, he's pretty
good. He's got good hands.
Yeah, we've played in pretty much every sport we can think of, I guess.
It's dangerous being a pitcher, though, because when he hits the ball, one time I got cracked in the head after he hit the ball. I cracked me in the head. Remember that?
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
It was funny for you. Not for me.
They used tennis balls after that. Brooks, who stands 6'2" with broad shoulders, admires his dad, who left a special school for the blind to attend public high school and eventually became Kentucky's first blind judge. But there is one thing David could never achieve.
I've been able to do most things I wanted to do in my life. I went to college. I went to law school. I practiced law. Now I'm a judge. So I've had a good, full life. But it has been one of the disappointments in my life that I'm not able to coach my kids on the field.
David says that announcing fills that void.
Come on, boys! The mic's off. I'm all right. I'm impartial.
As the game wears on, David faces the field with a worried look. With 30 seconds left, St. Xavier scores, winning by one touchdown. The receiver taunts the crowd.
Flag on the play. What's the call going to be?
It's going to be unsportsmanlike conduct, dead ball. They still will... They won't happen here. They're going to penalize them on the kickoff.
The game is over. David's 12-year-old son, Max, helps his dad navigate the steep spiral staircase out of the press box and down the bleachers. Once on the field, a stone-faced Brooks walks over. David gives his son a pat on the back and chokes up a bit.
You played a good game, buddy.
Thank you.
With tonight's loss, Manuel will likely lose its home field advantage in the playoffs, which means tonight could be Brooks' last home game and David's last night announcing. Standing in the end zone, Brooks nearby, David holds back tears and smiles.
My eyes were watering. One reason, because he smelled so bad after all those tackles and all the sweating. But the other reason, because I just love him so much, you know. So.
For Only a Game, I'm Ann Marshall in Louisville.
You're listening to Only a Game. We've covered the NBA lockout, of course, and at least one listener, Scott Dillman of Boston Spa, New York, wishes we hadn't. Who cares, he wrote. I won't miss the season at all. College ball is much more interesting. During my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week, Charlie made fun of Rob Sloan, the Brit who had finished toward the top of a marathon by riding a bus nearly to the finish line. Alan Silverman, who lives in Stone Ridge, New York, felt Charlie was a bit hard on Mr. Sloan. Recent archaeological findings prove that Pheidippides, the original marathoner, also took the bus, he wrote, and she was pregnant at the time. Fascinating. Several listeners emailed to say they'd enjoyed the story about rowing on the reclaimed Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. Jeff Bendix of Cleveland Heights wrote, "While I was aware that people were doing it, I had no idea how many or that major racing events were coming here. But couldn't you have come up with something other than Randy Newman's 40-year-old song, especially since the whole premise of the story was that the river is now clean enough for rowing competitions?" Mr. Bendix, we searched for a song about how clean the Cuyahoga is. No luck. We get lots of comments and questions about the music on Only a Game. The easiest way to learn about same is to visit onlyagame.org and click on Music Blog, though I'm not sure that blog mentions that I regard Randy Newman as a genius. My conversation with Melissa Holbrook Pearson, the author of The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, Long Distance Motorcycling's Endless Road, inspired Dave Pearson to email. I don't know if he's related to the author, but Mr. Pearson writes that he used to ride as many as 10,000 miles a year. He remembers that when he told his great-aunt from Texas that he'd ridden across the United States to, quote, see some of the country, she smiled and replied, "I expect you saw more than you needed." Apparently, Dave Pearson is also a master of the literary form that surfaces each year just before the Super Bowl on Only a Game. He opened his email with, "To haiku or not, whether 'tis better to write or forbearing end." Do you think he's hoping that after 18 years we will retire Super Bowl haiku? Dave, thanks. I hear you. But Super Bowl haiku stays. Take a week off, pal. You can express your feelings regarding haiku or anything else by contacting us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
I heard the news today. Oh boy, a hole-in-one by a guy from Lancashire. And it gets better. Peter Osborne, the guy who lives in Lancashire in Scotland, suffers from maculopathy. He's essentially blind, but playing last weekend, Mr. Osborne whacked a drive on the 14th hole at Balbirnie Park in Glenrothes Fife. He thought he did it pretty well, but he, of course, couldn't see where the ball went. Neither could his guide, John Murray, whose best guess was that Osborne's drive had found the bunker beside the green. But not so. His ball turned up in the cup. And how does a blind golfer celebrate such an occasion? Pretty much as any other golfer would, as it turns out. According to John Murray, quote, "We enjoyed a wee nip of malt that Peter produced at the 19th. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, adventure racing for those unafraid of mud pits, warriors with spears, things of that nature. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
After 3 days of sometimes intense negotiation, talks ended on Thursday between the NBA Players Association and the team owners. Now there's speculation that games may be canceled through Christmas, and even the entire season could go away. Good news for everybody, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a deal that helps neither side, which I think is the definition of an even deal. I have no illusions about the fact that this is what the NBA owners wanted all along. One thing that keeps eluding my brethren in the press is that a lockout is, in all cases, a management strategy. So naturally, there's this second stage to the strategy, which is to lose the season. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
The Texas Rangers drew even with the St. Louis Cardinals in Game 2 of the World Series. Game 3 tonight, we'll find Dirk Nowitzki of the Dallas Mavericks on the mound to throw out the first pitch. So it's all in good fun, and nobody could possibly have objected to that, right?
Ah, you've reckoned without Bud Selig, my friend. A man who has a really good World Series beginning on his hands here has decided to be as petty as he possibly could and stand behind his greedy brethren in the NBA and was actually questioning whether or not Nowitzki could be throwing out the first pitch while the NBA was locking out its players. Cooler heads have apparently prevailed. Sanity is apparently reigning once again in Texas, and Nowitzki will throw out the first pitch.
Charlie, no matter who wins this World Series, relief pitcher Arthur Rhodes will get himself a championship ring. How'd he work that?
He started the year with the Rangers. This is great. Arthur Rhodes, if Arthur Rhodes doesn't have a chaise lounge in the bullpen with his feet up and a cool beverage with a straw and an umbrella in it, I'd be very disappointed in him. The guy is absolutely in the catbird seat. They could tie, and he would get two rings.
People who assumed that the NFL lockout ended because the league's owners and players had learned to agree on everything were apparently wrong. What did the two sides disagree about this week?
Well, the union is saying that they're not going to swing with blood testing for human growth hormones. The league is, of course, stamping its feet. The drug warriors are having hysterics and conniption fits, which is their profession anyway. You've got Congress sort of meddling around, and the union, I think, is going to stand on this for a while, and good for them.
As you know, I don't watch a lot of pro football, but if you can tell me which of this weekend's games is most likely to end with two coaches having at each other, I will tune in for that. Should I watch Jets-Chargers?
Well, this is going to be a weekly deal now, I think. They're going to arrange to have coaches fight at the end of every game. So there can be 20 minutes of deploring the whole matter in the wrap-up shows. Yeah, Rex Ryan and North Turner have been yapping at each other. Both teams, by the way, have bigger problems than coaches yelling at each other, and they should tend to their business.
Driving very fast around an oval in the company of more than a score of other people doing the same thing has always been dangerous and potentially fatal. On Sunday, the Las Vegas Motor Speedway was the site of a 15-car crash that killed one driver, Dan Weldon. Was that particular race designed in a particularly dangerous way?
Yes, it was. You should not be in the situation of having to have a 15-car pileup in an IndyCar race. Having IndyCars race on an unsafe, too-fast track and racing 4 and 5 wide is just stupid. And there are a lot of people right now with blood on their hands.
One of the teams in England's Premiership has tested the DNA of their players in order to learn more about what predisposes soccer players to injuries. Any worries about the consequences of this particular application of science to sports?
Quack, 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 quack. Excuse me. Yeah, they're looking for genetic mutations linked to an increased chance of injuries like ruptured tendons and stuff. The professor who carried out the research said, I have no idea which players they were, but there were some really good genes in there.
What a surprise. You know, I must say, I expected you to say something about how soccer players are always falling over and clutching their knees for no reason at all.
Well,
how could they learn anything?
Is there a genetic mutation attached to, like, acting? I mean, does Ronaldo and Al Pacino have the same gene?
I know that for lots of fans, there's no such thing as too much football, but how many of them would still feel that way if they'd sat through last weekend's game in California between Desert Hot Springs High and Big Bear High?
Big Bear and Desert Hot Springs played 8 overtimes before Big Bear was able to win the game 56-50. This is the silly overtime rule where you get to play street football until somebody doesn't score.
The thing I love about this is imagining the conversations in the huddle with these kids saying, hand it off to him, man. I'm tired.
Let's run the play we ran 3.5 hours ago. They won't be.
They'll have forgotten.
They've forgotten it by now.
There was great celebration within the Weinroth family of Sedalia, Colorado, when one of the goats
Sports!
That they had raised was named grand champion at the Colorado State Fair. But I gather the celebration was short-lived. What happened?
The championship goat at the Colorado State Fair flunked his drug test. There was some unapproved feed additive in his feed, and he was disqualified. Yeah. And since the goat can't speak for himself, goats being able to only say, nyah! His family is saying he's been framed.
Yeah.
Goat set him up.
Sabotage.
Goat set him up. It was his cousin's feed additive. Yeah, that'll do it.
Not my drugs.
Not his drugs, no.
And finally, Charlie, lots of golf courses feature water hazards, and now I understand that there is, in the works, a water hazard that features a golf course. What's that all about?
Yes, an 18-hole course in the Maldives are going to be made up entirely of artificial islands, each of them featuring two or three homes. So you could, like, you know, sort of like live in the landing area on a par five, you know, which I'm sure would be really convenient for backyard barbecues. Tsunamis, I would think, would be a problem. Sharks might be a little bit of a drawback here on the course. Of course, if you put me on a golf course, which is 90% water and 10% grass, and you're supposed to hit it in the water, I'll hit it in the grass all the time.
Charlie Pierce blogs about politics for Esquire magazine, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Don't eat that stuff. The New York City Marathon began in 1970 with just 127 participants. In 2 weeks, more than 50,000 runners will take to the starting line for the 42nd running of the event. Last year, a record 510,000 Americans completed marathons. But for some, running 26.2 miles just doesn't offer enough of a challenge. For those, there is adventure racing. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
One, two.
On a hot and sunny Saturday morning in late August, the Amesbury Sports Park, a little less than an hour north of Boston, has been transformed into ancient Sparta, or sort of a modern ancient Sparta. A shirtless guy in a red floor-length cape and plumed helmet is running microphone checks, while an equally shirtless but helmetless guy is doing push-ups and waiting for his turn to race.
Name's Mike Pye. I'm a Spartan warrior.
You are already a Spartan warrior.
I appreciate that, but I gotta earn that first.
Mike is about to set out on his first Spartan sprint. At just 5K, or 3.1 miles, the sprint is the shortest of the Spartan races, but don't let the distance fool you. While a slow runner can finish a 5K in a half hour, it will take twice as long for most participants to finish this obstacle-filled run up and down the side of a mountain.
Spartans, on this rugged patch of earth, we stand to fight. There is no retreat, no surrender. That is Spartan law.
If those words are familiar, it's probably because Gerard Butler delivered them in the movie 300. And yes, both speeches end with the foreboding words, "For tonight we dine in hell." In 2005, Joe DeSena founded the Spartan Death Race, a 48-hour obstacle course which quickly evolved into a series of shorter events held all over the United States and Canada. This morning, DeSena led a group of 250 through this course, adding extra challenges at every obstacle and stretching the three-mile race to more than 2 hours. Now, he's eating a banana and philosophizing on why people pay good money to be tortured by increasingly tougher physical tasks.
This is going to sound crazy, but for 900,000 plus years, humans jumped, crawled, swam, climbed. This is what we're wired to do. We're animals. We forgot that we're animals. I'm just allowing animals to play the way they like to play.
Every 30 minutes, Spartans are sent charging up the hill through a dense cloud of stage smoke. The course twists and turns on dirt paths littered with rocks and tree roots. There are walls to climb over, under, and through, mud pits to navigate, and what might just be the longest barbed wire crawl in history, through mud, uphill, while being sprayed with a fire hose.
I'm leaving Sparta after this.
The more people complain, the wider DeSena smiles.
I've been next to Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and they've cursed at me and said they're currently in the military and they've never done anything quite like it. You're carrying weight, you're crawling through things, you're in the mud, you're throwing spears. I'm bringing back all those primal, innate instincts in a human being.
Throwing a spear at a target made of hay isn't as innate as DeSena might think. If a spear doesn't stick, and most of them don't, volunteers cheerfully watch as the racer performs 30 burpees, a full body exercise used by football coaches and military drill instructors when push-ups aren't considered punishment enough.
Oh, close.
I hit it. It didn't stick.
Okay, you only have to do 30.
30's not bad, though.
But I did 120 already.
Oh, my God.
Only 8 people showed up for DeSena's first event. More than 8,000 showed up for his 10th. It's an amazing rate of growth, and DeSena's Spartan Series isn't the only competitor in a crowded adventure race market.
I heard we had, you know, one of the Grey's Anatomy celebrities was apparently on site.
Amelia Richmond is the PR manager for Squaw Valley USA in Northern California, where celebrities and non-celebrities alike climbed 3,500 feet of vertical and tackled 24 obstacles during a Tough Mudder event last month.
They erected basically a high dive. People had to jump off on into this very cold water. And then that was, you know, just kind of the tip of the iceberg. There were ice baths and log carries and electric shocker nodes.
Yes, you heard right. She said electric shocker nodes. Tough Mudders must pass through 10,000 volts of electricity on their way to the finish line, where they receive a medal but no official time. The Tough Mudder is considered an endurance event, not a race. Englishman Will Dean came up with the idea in 2008 while studying for his MBA at the Harvard Business School. He wrote up a business plan and showed it to a few professors. He says they all agreed it was a, quote, categorically stupid idea. He pulled together an $8,000 marketing budget and scheduled his first event for May of 2010 anyway. 5,000 participants signed up in just 5 weeks. Even Dean was amazed.
I would have never have guessed, and I don't think any Harvard Business School professors in our second year of operations would be doing 150,000 participants to our events and $25 million in revenues, or that we would have 1 million Facebook fans or 35 staff. So it's been a pretty insane first 2 years for us.
1,000 people have already had the Tough Mudder logo permanently tattooed on their bodies. And, like any good business school graduate, Dean has studied the trend behind his success.
You know, experiences are a luxury good, and they're a luxury good that are worth spending a lot of money on because, you know, unlike the latest iPhone, it's not going to be something that's out of date or useless a year or two from now.
Dean says people put the highest priority on experiences they can share with their friends. That's certainly something that's brought Cynthia August of Ipswich, Massachusetts, to adventure racing time and time again. She started doing mud runs and warrior dashes a few years ago after completing a cross-country 5K with a group of girlfriends.
So we all finished together. We're like, yeah, we're awesome. We're pumped. And then one of us said, triathlon? And we all looked at each other and went, yeah, you know, and then there was a pinky pact, and that was that.
Cynthia's in her 40s and says adventure racing is her midlife crisis. There have been moments when she thought she might die from exhaustion, but she says she never considered quitting.
It's about survival, and I think it goes back to that reaching a certain point in your life where you understand that you are in control of your own ability to survive things and make it through things, and to continually reaffirm that your own power of will is enough. Giving up has never really ever been on my mind, especially when I'm in a tutu. I mean, come on, who quits in a tutu?
Cynthia has run through apple orchards, scaled walls, and pulled mud from places she didn't even know existed. Still, she says, she's always looking for the next challenge.
Heck, there are people at the race before the race that are running around pressing pamphlets in your hand going, have you seen this one? How about this one? Hey, look at this one. This one has lobsters.
It leaves one to wonder, what's next? After defeating electric shocker nodes and football field lengths of barbed wire, where can athletes find a new challenge?
We came up with the name, and it was Run for Your Lives, and we said, well, what are people going to run from? And it just seemed zombies was the perfect fit.
Yep, you heard right again, zombies. Derek Smith is the co-founder of Run for Your Lives, a race debuting today in Darlington, Maryland, an hour north of Baltimore. The event generated enormous buzz, and volunteer zombie positions filled up even faster than the race itself. Smith says many of the nearly 10,000 registered runners are former couch potatoes who were inspired by the race's unusual theme. And he offers some sage advice.
Expect the unexpected, I suppose. You know, it's not just be physically fit, but you're also going to have to be mentally aware of which direction to go and what's going to be the most efficient way to get to the finish line.
Do you have any advice for the zombies?
Zombies? No, I have no insight to how a zombie's mind works, if it does work.
Like a lot of her friends, Cynthia August is ready to sign up.
You know, zombies are so trendy, but really cool in that it's basically a little bit like flag football in that everybody's got flags and they are your lives. And so if the zombies get your flags, then you're dead. And that's genius. That's just cool.
You're not dead, you're a zombie.
Oh, you're a zombie?
You finish as a zombie.
Oh, that's even better. God, that's good.
Soon, August won't have to fly to Baltimore to run from zombies. More than a month before today's inaugural race, Run for Your Lives announced a schedule that includes 7 more events across the country in 2012 in Boston, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Pittsburgh, the Pacific Northwest, Southern California, and Austin, Texas. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jillian Guybe. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen's adventure race photo gallery or Ann Marshall's pictures of announcer David Holton or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from adventure racers Jonathan Nilsson and Mike Ives, who are wearing the same thing and proud of it.
You know, one guy in a tuxedo t-shirt kind of looks like an idiot, but two guys, well, that's brilliant.
All right, all you need now is some socks that look like spats, and you can spray paint on some garters. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.